Which would you rather be? Fairly good across a range of skills or completely brilliant at just one thing? On RN, this is The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. This week about two people who were deeply driven to do one thing, to dance. The two most famous male ballet dancers of the 20th century were Vaclav Nijinsky and Rudolf Nureyev. Nureyev was often compared to Nijinsky, and there are for sure parallels between them. For a start, they both went to the same ballet school in St. Petersburg, Leningrad.
You know, a ballet class is a kind of exercise in trying to mold your body into more and more perfect shapes. And most people try to do that through calculation. Nureyev did it by force. That's how he moved. And I think that's probably, you know, one of the things that made people compare him to Nijinsky, who had the same kind of sense of almost withheld explosion.
After ballet school, both Nijinsky and Nureyev graduated into the same company. Although, like all things in the decades that separated them, the names changed, from the Imperial Theatre to the Kirov. Both left Russia, the USSR, for the West, first to Paris, where each of them, some 50 years apart, was a sensation.
Rudolf Nureyev, the Soviet ballet star who walked out on the Leningrad State Kirov Ballet and asked for asylum in France, is to dance in the country of his adoption.
Nureyev and Nijinsky before him were both great dancers, no doubt about that. But their fame, their celebrity, their notoriety rested on much more than that.
The press in Paris learned that Nureyev declined to be sent back to Russia, knowing that he was very much out of favour with the authorities. At this stage, he would not say more, but continued his rehearsal for The Sleeping Beauty. Ballet experts declare that the young Russian is the Nijinsky of the 1960s.
Where Nijinsky embodied pre-revolutionary Russian exoticism, Nureyev, the Nijinsky of the 1960s, was living, breathing Soviet bravura at the height of the Cold War. And more on Rudolf Nureyev later here in The Body Sphere. Starting, though, with Vaclav Nijinsky. Now, you're bound to know that this year is the centenary of the Rite of Spring. Orchestras all around the world have been playing it all year. And a lot's been said about this groundbreaking music of Igor Stravinsky. Not enough has been said, though, I think, about the fact that it wasn't written for the concert hall. The Rite of Spring is ballet music, and the choreography by Nijinsky was as daring as the composition by Stravinsky.
On stage, as the audience reaction grew less inhibited, the frightened dancers struggled to hear the music over the noise of the crowd and forced themselves to keep moving. Trembling with fury, dripping with sweat beneath the stage lights, his face ashen, Nijinsky stood on a chair in the wings, frantically shouting out the time for them. Stravinsky, who had rushed backstage when the tumult began, was by his side. Desperately, Diaghilev switched the house lights on and off several times, appealing for calm.
Now there's a night at the theatre. That description of the first performance of the Rite of Spring in 1913, performed by Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, comes from Lucy Moore, who's written a new biography of Nijinsky. And the first thing to say about Nijinsky, I think, is that he was never going to be anything other than a dancer.
It's very hard to imagine what else he could have been. His parents were both Polish itinerant dancers. Both of them dance in these provincial theatres all across the Russian Empire, from Azerbaijan, modern Azerbaijan, to Kiev, you know, all over the Russian Empire. And they were often performing in things like circuses. His father was a choreographer for these small touring ballet companies that they worked for. So Nijinsky and his sister, Bronya, were immersed in dance from a very young age. And it's just impossible to imagine that he could have done anything else.
Well, when he was nine, Nijinsky was taken into the Imperial Theatre School in St. Petersburg. Quickly, he became the rising star of the company once he graduated, the ballet company that's now known as the Kirov. But his fame really comes in Paris in 1909 with the fledgling Ballet Russe, where he essentially redefines and remakes the male dancer, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Until this point, female dancers had been preeminent. Ballets were created around them. They were written for them. The stars of every show were women. This dated back to the early 19th century in France, where ballet had become a sort of dying art in some ways. There were no male dancers. Women danced male roles in male dress. In Russia, there was still a tradition of the male dancer, but they were subordinate, definitely, to these prima ballerinas assoluta, the great stars of the late 19th century. What's interesting is that Anna Pavlova was originally scheduled to star as the sort of great attraction of the first season of the Ballet Russe. She hedged her bets and didn't turn up for the first performances. At the last minute, she said she couldn't come, which allowed Diaghilev to present Nijinsky as his star. Pavlova was the bigger star. He would have had to have presented her as his star. But Pavlova's caution about supporting Diaghilev, waiting to see what would happen, how he would be received, allowed Diaghilev to present Nijinsky in this way.
And I think Pavlova probably never forgave Nijinsky for taking the limelight.
She said to his sister very openly, "I don't like to dance with Vatsa because people applaud for him and not for me."
Yeah. Well, now, Nijinsky wasn't exactly what we think of now, at least, as an ideal body shape for a ballet dancer. He was kind of short and stocky, wasn't he?
People always commented about how ordinary Nijinsky looked off stage, ordinary and dull and uninteresting, really, he looked off stage. And this was partly because he wasn't very articulate and he wasn't very chatty, really. But on stage, he seems to have possessed a completely extraordinary quality. People at the time watching were utterly, they don't describe other dancers in the same way they describe him. What he represented to audiences was something, it was a hugely potent, very sexually powerful being on stage. And I think he had what all great performers have, what all great stage performers have, was this ability to make himself look like anything on stage. So on stage, when he was playing a prince, he was tall, he was graceful, he was elegant. When he was playing a fawn, he was bestial and lithe. When he was playing a slave, he was craven and passionate, repressedly passionate. So he had an incredible ability, despite his physical attributes were brilliant for dancing. He had these incredibly powerful thighs. And so his body, while not tall and lithe and slender and elongated as we see dancers' bodies today, but it was very, very effective on stage.
The roles he played in the first few seasons of the Ballet Russe, he did tend to play slaves in a couple of ballets and also a puppet. Now, it's very hard not to read something into this.
Yes. Diaghilev was an impressive person. He was also very domineering of those closest to him, and many, many observers at the time saw the roles that he liked to place Nijinsky in as being somehow reflective of their personal relationship, with Diaghilev playing the charismatic impresario, the magician from Petrushka, and Nijinsky in the role of, as you say, puppet or slave. And I think that was something that Nijinsky really chafed against, increasingly came to resent Diaghilev's influence and power over him.
Well, he had an extremely complex relationship with Diaghilev, to say the least.
Yes. The best of their relationship was the sense of Nijinsky as the ideal performer and Diaghilev as the ideal audience. And in that sense, they were united. The idea of Diaghilev sitting in a darkened theatre, watching Nijinsky glowing on stage, both of them striving to capture the same perfection. I think that's the sort of strongest, you know, the most memorable aspect of their relationship. But the emotional control he did chafe against, and it was very destructive to both of them.
But also, Nijinsky had, as you say, classical technique plus iconoclastic creativity. And he turned pretty quickly to choreography with the Ballet Russe, first with Afternoon of a Fawn, with its scandalous climactic end, as well as the three-hander that he also danced in, Jure, and The Rite of Spring, which he didn't dance in. In general, Lucy, what would you say his choreographic interests were?
He used to say, "I'm a modern man. I want to create dances that reflect modern life, contemporary life." This was pretty unheard of in the ballet world at this time. And I think the best way to visualize it really is to think of painting. So if you think of the sort of great works of the 19th century that the Impressionists and the Post-Impressionists came along and tore down all the received wisdom of how a picture should look, that's what Nijinsky wanted to do with dance. And so although he was completely immersed in the classical technique and in his training, he never deviated from that. Even at his most experimental in terms of what he wanted to present on stage, he was still rigorously going through his classical training every day. But he needed both. He needed the structure and rigor and tradition of everything he'd learned throughout his life. And then it was his own, as you say, iconoclastic spirit that breathed something new into that.
And what was his choreographic method?
He was the first choreographer to work on the body of a dancer like a sculptor. The choreographers at the Imperial Theatre in late 19th century Russia had worked with quite a broad brushstroke. They were working with many, many dancers. It was a bit like a North Korean military parade, you know, the lines of dancers all in a row according to height, doing a sort of mass spectacle. Mikhail Fokine, who was the choreographer who created a lot of Nijinsky's great roles, was much more emotional, and he wanted a dancer to capture a mood or a feeling, and he gave them a broad brushstroke, but he allowed them to interpret their roles. Nijinsky worked out the roles so specifically on his own body and then communicated it to the dancers. So there's something in the afternoon of a fawn. Apparently in the rehearsals, one of the dancers was looking very frightened, and Nijinsky said, "Why are you looking so frightened?" And she said, "I thought that was the emotion you wanted me to express." He said, "No, everything I give you is in the movement. Your face doesn't matter. Your eyes don't matter. Everything is in the body."
It's actually quite a tyrannical method of composing movement.
Oh, absolutely. I think he probably was a bit of a tyrant.
You're listening to The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith, talking about one of the most famous creative bodies in the Western world in the first decades of the 20th century, Vaclav Nijinsky, with his biographer Lucy Moore. So let's talk about The Rite of Spring, this crazy, wild, modernist creation of Stravinsky and Nijinsky that caused such an uproar on its first night in Paris in 1913.
What was interesting about The Rite of Spring was that the music is the thing that's gone on to be hailed as the music of the 20th century, but the dancing was really what astonished people that night. But then Nijinsky's choreography wasn't performed again after that summer, so there was no chance for anybody to get used to how new it was or to sort of understand where it had come from.
Clearly, in that first season, not only the audience, but the dancers really struggled with The Rite of Spring, with this difficult music and difficult choreography. Did the creators, though, work at the time with mutual respect? I mean, did Nijinsky admire the music? Did Stravinsky admire the choreography?
Stravinsky and Nijinsky and Rurik, who designed the sets and costumes, their vision for the ballet was very much in line with one another's. Stravinsky and Nijinsky worked so closely together that the stomping of the dancers' feet on stage were noted down on Stravinsky's choreographic score. They were considered part of the score, and they were very excited about what they were producing, that they were going to make people see and hear things in entirely new ways. They really believed that.
But why then, later in the 1930s, was Stravinsky critical and diminishing of Nijinsky's role in Rite of Spring as choreographer?
I think there's a sense in which Stravinsky was very protective of his own reputation and his own greatness. And he was a little bit older than Nijinsky, so he felt he had a sort of stronger creative role, I suspect, when they were doing The Rite of Spring. Later on, he was very happy to dismiss Nijinsky, who, of course, couldn't defend himself because he was, by this stage, in and out of asylums and suffering from very severe mental illness. So there was no one to defend Nijinsky, and Stravinsky, I think, was very happy to almost to pretend that the Rite of Spring had just been concert music anyway and the ballet had been kind of attached to it and it was an unfortunate episode. But at the time when he spoke about it, he was talking about how he and Nijinsky were in total harmony. But when Nijinsky ran off and eloped, Diaghilev sacked him, their creative union splintered. And so therefore, Stravinsky, who had tied his kind of career to Diaghilev, knew that he would never work with Nijinsky again. And he was desperate. He said, you know, this is the beginning. This was the beginning of something really beautiful and really extraordinary. And we will never, now I won't be able to achieve all the things I wanted to achieve in ballet because I won't be working with Nijinsky again.
Well, as you say, later in that year of the Rite of Spring, 1913, Nijinsky got married in South America. Diaghilev sacked him from the Ballet Russe. And in the following years, Nijinsky's mental health became increasingly fragile. He couldn't go back to the new Russia. And in 1919, his wife, Romola, put him in an asylum in Switzerland. And a lot's been said about his mental state, you know, retrospective diagnoses that he was schizophrenic or bipolar or autistic. But it seems to me it's the assessment of Rudolf Nureyev, Nijinsky's equivalent in the second half of the 20th century, that speaks a simple truth from one who would probably know.
He said, I used to think that Nijinsky's mind had broken, you know, because there was something wrong with it. And now, this is, he was speaking later in his life, now I think that it broke because he couldn't dance, because he stopped dancing. And I think there is a sense that there was nothing else Nijinsky could do or wanted to do. A lot of his contemporaries wrote about believing that the Nijinsky they saw on stage was the true Nijinsky, and the Nijinsky they saw off stage was the sort of husk of a man that he inhabited in the moments between being able to be on stage. And I think Nureyev would have understood that sense more than anyone else. And there is, yes, that idea that only doing the thing that you do better than anybody else can you really be yourself.
The new biography of Nijinsky, simply called Nijinsky, is by Lucy Moore, who was speaking to us from London. Details for the book on the Bodysphere website. Amanda Smith with you, on air and online at RN. As Nijinsky only ever wanted to be a dancer, the same was true of Rudolf Nureyev. For Nureyev, it was much harder, though. His father was a political instructor in the Red Army and deeply opposed to his son becoming a dancer. Rudy grew up poor in a village near Ufa in the far-flung Soviet Republic of Bashkortostan.
I was born on a train on Trans-Siberian Railroad. Ufa was a very small city, and the most haunting sound of the city was the sound of the train. You could hear it for miles away, calling you, beckoning to go somewhere.
Rudolf Nureyev was the first dancer from the Soviet Union to defect to the West. Certainly he went somewhere. In 1961, when he was on tour with the Kirov Ballet in Paris, he asked for asylum, and everyone went crazy for him. Jennifer Homans is a dance historian and former dancer based in New York. She says that Nureyev caused a sensation because his life and art intersected at a sharp angle with history.
It's true that you could say this not just of Nureyev, but of ballet in general, that it was partly the huge rage that it was in the post-war period because it was the art of the Cold War. The Cold War was being fought on this cultural turf. So, you know, Nureyev walked right into that. Now, this was a guy who had enormous talent, aside from that, completely aside from that. And that was recognized early on. It's one of the reasons that the French insisted that he come. The Russians didn't want to send him. The Soviets didn't want to send him because they knew that he might defect. He was that good. He was dangerous. dangerously good, and he had a personality that was unreliable from their point of view. He was adventurous, with a certain disregard for the officials that wanted to control him. And when he came to Paris, he was a superstar. The thing about Nureyev's talent is that it wasn't just that he was a good technician. He wasn't that great a technician. He had a kind of pure physicality, and in this he really was similar to Nijinsky, a kind of animal exoticism, a power, a force, something that wasn't necessarily Apollonian perfection. It was much more Dionysian, much wilder.
Well, critics at the time talked about his cat-like way of holding himself and the large wild eyes and hollow cheeks and his bulging thighs. But what was it about Nureyev that meant he became that kind of pop idol of the 1960s?
He did a lot of things to make that happen. He posed nude. He was photographed in all kinds of fashion magazines. He sort of made the crossover into pop culture. He then almost immediately joined the Royal Ballet and in London and developed a partnership with its then reigning ballerina, Margot Fonteyn.
Who was everything he wasn't, really.
That's correct. She was, you know, old enough to be his mother. She was a kind of restrained, polite, British to the core kind of dancer. Perfect in her line, perfect in her sense of restraint. And he was all over the place. But, you know, together it was magnetic.
Well, as a dancer and as a choreographer, would you say Nureyev was an innovator or was he a traditionalist?
As a dancer, he was an innovator. He pushed the technique further than it had gone, especially male technique. He stood higher on his half point, in other words, higher up on his feet, and he turned his legs out in such a way. And then, you know, if he had his foot in a crooked position called passe, he would pull it way up by his thigh, not down by his knee. All of this gave him a kind of longer, leaner line and a sense of thrusting ambition. I once watched him take class, and it was quite an experience because, you know, a ballet class is a kind of exercise in trying to mold your body into more and more perfect shapes. And most people try to do that through calculation. Nureyev did it by force, and he would stand at that bar and he would just put himself there. And he wore these woolen caps on his head so that he could keep the heat in. So there was this sense of this compressed energy and this compressed vitality that was just going to make this technique work. And that's how he moved. And I think that's probably, you know, one of the things that made people compare him to Nijinsky, who had the same kind of sense of almost withheld explosion.
As a choreographer?
Much more conservative taste, quite old-fashioned. He was very interested in the Russian classics. He wanted to bring what he knew to the West, and there, in a way, he was trying to introduce a kind of Soviet style into a European and American context. He was adventurous as a dancer. He wanted to work with all kinds of contemporary choreographers and new work. But when he came to mounting ballets himself, which he did especially at the end of his career when he was the director of the Paris Opera, the productions are huge. They're spectacles. They're vehicles for bravura technique.
Yes, I saw his Sleeping Beauty that he did with the London Festival Ballet, and he was still dancing. And that was the most lavish production I have ever seen in my life of a ballet.
Yeah. In that sense, he had a kind of nostalgia for the world he had left. And don't forget, he wasn't allowed to return. He was tried in absentia after he defected. He was persona non grata. He was erased from Soviet culture for this betrayal.
Well, Nureyev and Nijinsky years earlier, for all their talent and fame, both, I think, retained a sense of being outsiders. How did that help or hinder Nureyev?
He was a kind of, you know, he was given a lot of latitude. He did a lot of very outrageous things, and his sex life was notorious. He kind of got away with it.
as an artist, the outsiderness was part of the complicated person that he was. He never did really fit in anywhere, and I imagine he was quite lonely in a sort of deep core kind of way. His dancing had that element of desperation. You know, the ambition, you have to wonder where that ambition came from. He never stopped. And as somebody who had given up his country, his family, everything he knew, that was part of who he was as an artist.
Well, Nijinsky died at the age of 61, though his life had been much diminished for years and years. Nureyev was 54 when he died of an AIDS-related illness. They both ended up kind of sad stories, really.
You know, they do end up sad stories. I mean, for very different reasons. Nijinsky went mad. Nureyev fell to the lifestyle that he had adopted. He danced and played and lived so hard and with such a disregard for his own body. This is kind of a paradox, isn't it? That even when he became very ill with AIDS, he didn't stop. He kept going with a kind of relentless disregard for anything. But this powerful need to dance, which was really the driving force of his entire life.
And this year is the 20th anniversary of his death. Giving us her insights into Rudolf Nureyev, Jennifer Homans, the author of Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet. She's a former ballet dancer and scholar in residence at New York University, speaking via Skype from New York. And that snippet of Rudolf Nureyev speaking at the beginning of the interview from the 1991 documentary film about him. So what do you think? Would you rather be totally brilliant at one thing, dance in both the cases we've been speaking about here, or generally okay across a range of things? Maybe it's not an either-or situation, but it pretty much was with both Nijinsky and Nureyev. As always, your thoughts welcome, and thank you for all the robust comments from last week's program. abc.net.au/radionational. Choose the Body Sphere in the program list. I'm Amanda Smith.